replied, other than to say he had put himself in the wrong place at the wrong time. Nicole found this comforting because it allayed some troubling suspicions she'd had about who might be responsible. Nicole was a very professional young woman, a private person who kept control of her emotions and tended not to share her personal life with many people, especially those she worked with. So nobody on the set knew anything about all this except Chad. But now we all realized how hard this must have been for her. One of the marketing guys told us that he had given Nicole a ride from the hotel to the set that day and took a back route along an inland channel where they had come upon a sign saying manatees could be seen at that spot. He stopped the car and they went down to the water, where there was a big gathering of these funny-looking sea mammals splashing around. Manatees, also known as sea cows, are an endangered species adored around Tampa Bay, where "Save the Manatees" is a common battle cry. It's said that ancient sailors, including Christopher Columbus, thought manatees were mermaids, a mistake that could only be made by men who have been at sea for 6 months. Manatees can weigh a ton, and they look like hippos with flippers. They're as gentle as puppies, and they like to play with people in the water, especially if those people scratch their enormous round bellies, for which they might get an actual sea cow kiss. You can't help but smile when you see a manatee, but when Nicole saw them in the channel that morning, the big wet lugs seemed to turn her somber. Nicole explained why. "The manatees were like our special animal," she said. "Roger was a really sweet, sensitive guy, and he had a thing for manatees. He would get mad at all the boats in the waterways because the manatees were so slow they couldn't get out of the way of the propellers. And so when I came to Tampa for the first time, he taught me about them. We went and looked at some, and I started to fall in love with them. After that, they represented us being together. We would send each other manatee cards and manatee stuff. So whenever I see a manatee, of course, I think of Roger." Chad suggested that we take a few minutes to break the tension of what had been a powerful experience for all of us. Nicole unhooked her mic and stood up, and without a second's hesitation, started walking back towards the door through which she had come. She sat down and peered across the bay, completely lost in thought. And then she got back up and started walking toward the wood stairway to the beach, and then out to the pier. I had this overwhelming feeling, a pull, that brought me out to the dock, she would recall later that day. Nicole made her way slowly, barefoot, to the end of the dock. When Nicole came back to the house, she had an amazed look on her face. It seemed that she was crying again. "You're not going to believe this," she said. "When I got to the end of the dock, I was standing there, thinking about Roger, wishing there was some way he could give me a sign that what happened today was all true. And at that moment, I looked down into the water, and right in front of me, there was a manatee. He lifted his lips out of the water and looked right at me. Then he swam away. I felt it was his way of saying goodbye and that I could have some peace. If there weren't all these people here, I swear I would have jumped in with him." A skeptic might say, well, this was Tampa Bay. It's nothing special to see a manatee there. Yes, except for this. As a member of the endangered species list, the warm water manatee is scarce enough in summer. This was February. It's a good winter if there were a couple of hundred of them in the entire 400-square-mile bay, and, as the owner of the house told us, those few will not be found anywhere near the cold waters where we were. They winter together in only the places they can survive, in the inland channels where Nicole had seen them earlier, and in the spa-like waters around factories and power plants way on the other side of the bay. No wonder Nicole's manatee just said a quick hello and turned around. He must have been freezing. That whole thing with Nicole, that was really impressive. Even after 16 years of hanging out in the intercosmic airspace between the physical and spirit worlds, and after making a career of it for 6, I'm neither blasé nor jaded. Hardly a week goes by when I'm not in awe of something that happens around me. And when it's one of those extraordinary, unforgettable experiences like that day on Tampa Bay, I feel honored to be a part of it. It's not a case of, wow, look at what I just did. Sometimes I really amaze myself. No, I don't see it as something I did. I see it as something they did. I'm just lucky they chose me as the conduit. After all, I have never been able to come up with a satisfying explanation of why I have this ability. And that's the only thing I call it. An ability, not a gift. As I see it, the only gift is the privilege of participating in a circle of energy from God Himself. I receive, interpret, and deliver messages from the spirit side to a recipient on this side. The recipient understands, accepts, and hopefully appreciates these messages. And that appreciation rebounds back to the other side. It's the completion of the energy circle that I see as the real gift. And it never gets old. Proving Grounds, 20, 60, 20. Looking back on it now, the infomercial was a failure in every way but the most important one. It introduced me to the essence of television. It gave me a tremendous education in the marketing of a medium and the importance of protecting the integrity of the work in a world crawling with people whose main interest is exploiting it. Yes, a big blinking yellow light from the boys, especially now that so many people were watching. I can't prove this, but I feel safe in saying that more people than ever before are coming to believe in either the fact or the possibility of an accessible afterlife. And they're not just the people who have always been believers. When I first began doing group readings and lectures, the audience was almost all female, mostly middle-aged, and from working-class backgrounds. Now I see a much more diverse crowd. There are many more men, even if some of them are still, well, dragged there because their wives want them there. More younger people, and more people who would have dismissed what I do as ridiculous not too long ago. They may still be skeptical, but they're willing to consider the possibilities. And that's good enough for me. I can work with an open mind. When it comes to spirit communication, it's a 20-60-20 world. 20% are true believers. You don't have to convince them of anything. In fact, a percentage of this percentage can be so uncritical, so unskeptical, that they'll believe anything. And that's not good. For one thing, they can be taken in by a less than competent, less than scrupulous psychic. And they may be so consumed with grief and a need to hold on that they forget that they're still living here and their loved ones are living there. And that's an important distinction. This subgroup can be as frustrating to me as people who believe nothing. Speaking of which, that's the second group of 20%. These are the true non-believers, what I refer to as the cynics. Whether it's fear of the unknown or just an ingrained, overly intellectualized belief system, they have no need to consider the possibility, let alone explore it. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust, they know for a fact that when you're dead, you're dead. Skeptics, cynics, whatever you call them, their minds are closed for business. Don't even bother. Then, there is the great middle class, the 60% who aren't sure what they believe or don't believe. But they're interested, open, and more than likely would like to believe. They just need a good reason. Most people, probably even the confirmed cynics, would like to think that there is something more after this. The cynics won't find out there is until, well, they get there. Can you imagine their reactions the moment that happens? But for the majority of people, all it takes is a convincing personal experience to remove or at least chip away at the doubt that comes naturally. There's nothing wrong with that. Skepticism is healthy, so long as it doesn't keep people from at least poking their heads through the curtain for a look-see. It's that 60% I think of most when I'm working. I'm trying to do as much as I can to raise the curtain. Not that it's my goal to convince or convert anyone, let alone everyone, but I would like people to have a meaningful experience and to leave with as much information and understanding as possible so that they can make their own judgments. This doesn't necessarily mean delivering a jaw-dropping reading every single time. First, I can't do that. Second, that might not even be enough for some people, even those who are open to the possibility of another existence after this one. People grieve in different ways, and even a great reading by a medium will not take the place of the process people must go through to survive their pain of the physical loss. No matter how many validating facts I give them, even if they have absolutely no doubt that the person they loved was in the room with them, talking to them through me, they know they will never see that person again. Most people feel some comfort from a positive reading, and many are profoundly moved. But others find it confusing and upsetting. Not everybody embraces my work, even if they believe in the afterlife. For example, even though the afterlife is a key tenet of my own Catholic Church, and many Catholics openly include spirit communication in their own lives, the Church itself seems to frown on it. It's part of the process. not just deciding whether you believe, but figuring out what it means if you do. Just as I want people to understand the process as I see it, I need to understand how it feels to them, and also try to appreciate their point of view. Process. That's probably my favorite word in all of this. The vast majority of people have never been exposed to the unfiltered reality of a reading by a medium. Misconceptions and mythology are the grunge we in the field are constantly trying to scrub away. That's why the mass media gets us excited. It gives us the willies. Whether it's journalism, entertainment, or that stuff all over TV that you can't identify as one or the other, you never know what you're going to get when you say yes. Unless, of course, you have your own show. But let's not talk about that right away. Let's talk about the first call I received from Lisa Jackson late in 1998. I was interested, but wary. Lisa was with Linda Ellerbee's Lucky Duck Productions. And she was producing a documentary on after-death communication, ADC. It wasn't the usual fare for Ellerbee's company. This was at a time when I was making my first tentative steps into television, planning the infomercial. Judy Guggenheim had recommended me to Lisa, and she wanted to see if I might be one of the mediums she could build a documentary around. After a few conversations, I was pretty sure I didn't want to be on the program. I didn't know what kind of show they were planning. A debunking could almost be taken for granted, and a real hatchet job always had to be considered. And going on camera without having any control over how it came out made me very uncomfortable. The shows I was going on to promote the book were essentially unedited interview shows, not taped and neatly packaged programs that could be slanted in whatever direction the people making it wanted. And I still had no burning desire to see my face on TV. If something that appealed to me came up, fine. If not, even better. What caught my imagination most was Lisa's ambition. She wanted to go beyond the standard approach, is, insert your medium here, speaking to the dead, and break some new ground. Her enterprising idea was to have some of the leading mediums tested by a University of Arizona psychologist who had developed an interest in survival of consciousness research. Lisa said it hadn't been determined yet how he would be tested, but that this professor, along with his wife, a fellow psychologist, had some interesting ideas. And HBO was now prepared to foot the bill. I was intrigued by the idea. With my strong desire to increase knowledge about mediumship and my affinity for healthcare and medicine, not to mention my perennial curiosity about what exactly goes on in my brain, I was tantalized by the idea of a scientist being brave enough to open an area of research for spirit communication. But at the same time, I wanted to know what I was getting involved with. Who was this guy and what was his point of view? What prejudices might he be bringing to the table with him? And most important, what kinds of tests did he have in mind? Lisa thought I should talk to Suzanne Northrup, who was also thinking about participating. Suzanne is a wonderful medium from New York whose skill and integrity, not to mention toughness, are beyond question. Suzanne's doing this? I asked Lisa. And before I called Suzanne, she called me. Are you doing this? She asked. Talking about it made both of us want to pursue this further. We both felt that if a serious academic researcher wanted to study spirit communication in an honest and open-minded way, we shouldn't let the opportunity pass without even talking to the guy. Testing, testing. Gary Schwartz is a unique man. He's the kind of college professor who really takes the concept of academic freedom to heart. A bearded New York native in his 50s, he started out as an electrical engineering student at Cornell, but wound up with a doctorate in psychology from Harvard. He stayed on the faculty there for 5 years, then went to Yale for a dozen more. His specialty was psychophysiology, the study of the mind-body connection. As the director of a Yale center devoted to research in that field, he studied biofeedback, the mind-body relationship to emotion and pain, and the treatment of stress-related disorders. Gary got a prestigious award for his work in 1986, which made the pages of Time magazine. But Ivy League academics being what they are, some of his fellow professors were less appreciative of his ingenuity than others. Some of my colleagues at Yale thought it was terribly creative, he says, and the other ones thought it was just terrible. And that's how Gary wound up in the desert. he loved the Southwest, but more important, he found the University of Arizona a more welcoming place for independent thinkers such as himself. He moved there in 1988, and they even gave Gary his own fancy-sounding lab. He named it the Human Systems Energy Laboratory. That's Gary's baby. He and his colleagues began doing research in mind-body medicine, energy medicine, and eventually, the thing that really got his juices flowing, spiritual medicine. Research into the possibility that there is survival of consciousness after physical death. Survival of consciousness is not an issue considered by many serious scientists, but it's one Gary has been thinking about for nearly 20 years. He actually wanted to try to figure out the answer and prove it scientifically. Back at Yale in the early 80s, Gary had begun ruminating on the whole idea of universal memory, the theory that everything is alive, eternal, and evolving. He had theorized that anytime two things share energy and information, they become a feedback system. Whether it's the hydrogen and oxygen that make up water, two strands of DNA, two heart cells, two people, or the Earth and the Moon, these systems are exchanging information and energy that become a permanent part of the universe. It accumulates over time and turns into memory. To Gary, this theory predicts everything from cell memory, for instance, the confirmed cases of heart transplant recipients experiencing personality changes that match their donors, to near-death, out-of-body experiences, and ultimately, the survival of consciousness after physical death. The essence of the theory is that there's no such thing as true death of anything, only transition. This would be terribly controversial, to put it mildly, Gary says, so I didn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. In fact, I didn't tell anybody about it. He wasn't even sure if he believed it himself. It was an elegant theory, but it didn't fit with the assumption he'd grown up with, that death is the end. He wasn't sure he would ever take this idea out of its box in the basement. At least, not as long as he wanted to keep his career. And then this private, purely professional interest converged with something very personal. In 1993, Gary went to a conference and found his soulmate. Her name was Linda Russick, and she was a fellow psychologist living in Boca Raton, Florida. A few weeks later, Gary went to Florida to visit Linda. Gary recalled that at 4 in the morning, as she drove him to the airport, she asked him a question that nobody had ever asked him before. She said, "Gary, do you believe in the possibility of survival of consciousness after death?" The reason she was asking was that her father had died 3 years earlier. "Do you believe that my father can still be here?" Linda's father had been a very well-known cardiologist. He had run the annual meetings of the American College of Cardiologists for 23 years, published 200 papers, and edited 7 books. And he did clinical work with his daughter. Linda had a very, very close relationship with her father, Gary says. When he died in 1990, Linda went on a scientific and metaphysical quest to see if she could prove whether he was still here. When Linda asked Gary if he believed that this could be possible, he asked her if it mattered what he thought. "Yes," she said, "because you're a serious scientist, and if you believe it, then you have to have a reason, and probably a good one." Gary told Linda that it so happened that he had thought about this a lot, but for reasons of self-preservation had kept it to himself. "I don't know if my logic is correct," he said, speaking these words to a colleague for the very first time. "I don't know if nature works this way, but based on what I know about physics, chemistry, and biology, I think it's very plausible that survival of consciousness can exist." Linda moved to Arizona, and over the next few years, they began quietly exploring the big question. Gary recorded Linda's brainwaves while she tried to contact her father. He put special high-frequency microphones around her, capable of recording sounds that vibrate 4 times higher than anything the human ear can hear, to see if there was anything in a high-frequency range that might occur when a deceased person was in the area. No wonder he made Linda promise they wouldn't talk about this with anyone. As a scientist, Gary feels uncomfortable talking about these early, informal experiments, but says they were suggestive enough to lead us to continue. One day in late 1998, Gary got a call from Lisa Jackson in New York. She told him she was working on a documentary for HBO called Life After Life and that it was going to be a serious examination of spirit communication. Gary is no fool. The only thing that held him back in his research in survival of consciousness was funding. The National Institutes of Health were not going to be writing him a check anytime soon so he could do experiments with people who talked to dead people. To get funding to research that, he'd pretty much have to be a psychiatrist studying schizophrenia. So Gary saw an opportunity. If you're really interested in the science of spirit communication, he told Lisa Jackson, if you really want to do something serious and special, then you guys should fund what would be the first ever laboratory investigation of psychic mediumship. All we would need are the mediums. Lisa's response? What if I could deliver the top mediums to your lab? When I called Gary Schwartz, I expected a short conversation that would most likely be followed by a phone call to Lisa politely declining her invitation to participate. If his proposed dead or alive test was any indication, he was probably a little too academic for my tastes. And I wasn't sure he wasn't just out to discredit us. Although, why would he bother? That wouldn't exactly be seen as bold, groundbreaking work. But what happened was that we wound up spending 2 hours on the phone in a very intense discussion and debate about the afterlife, our connection to it, and what might be provable. Suzanne had the same conversation with Gary and the same reaction. We both called Lisa Jackson and said we would go to Tucson, Arizona. We wouldn't do the dead or alive test, but Gary seemed eager to hear our ideas. Great, Lisa said. Go out there and figure it out. Just make sure that whatever you decide, it's for HBO. Lisa Jackson found the idea of measuring our heart and brain waves very exciting. She knew hooking up electrical leads to the brains of mediums would look great on film. Maybe they would discover something interesting. But even if they wound up being just bells and whistles for the camera, we were going to be part of a landmark event. Gary had a completely open field. Suzanne and I weren't afraid to be put to the test, but filming the research for television did raise the stakes. We would not have any control over editing and presentation. And what if we had a bad day, or the sitter was uncooperative or was uninformed about the family tree? It could be a disaster. And not just for us, but for the whole field. But the best case scenario was really exciting to think about. If it went well, millions of people would see up close and for the first time a legitimate university researcher delivering evidence of communication with the spirit world. The only thing left for Lisa to do was recruit a few more mediums and a sitter or two. She called George Anderson. He quickly agreed. And so did another medium, Ann Gaiman. Gary also asked Lori Campbell, a homemaker from California who had participated in earlier studies. Suzanne had only one point she wanted Gary to pay careful attention to. And that was that all mediums work differently, she told him. I know you want a controlled experiment, but you have to give us license to work the way we work. We'll play it your way, Gary assured her. We're going to do everything in our power to make it possible for a phenomenon, if it's real, to emerge. I flew to Tucson straight from shooting the infomercial in Tampa, Florida. Gary and Linda told us the plan for the next day. The five mediums would be brought into a room one by one to read the sitter the producers had recruited. The others would wait in a courtyard behind the lab. Inside the reading room, we would sit side by side with the sitter, a few feet apart and with a screen between us. We wouldn't see the sitter before or during the reading. We would only get yes and no answers to the messages we relayed. Both medium and sitter would be wired up to see if there was any correlation between our hearts during the reading. The mediums would also have electrodes attached to their heads to record brain waves. The cameras would record it all, and Gary and Linda would keep a careful list of every piece of information we generated. Eventually, the sitter would evaluate transcripts of the readings, and our performances would be compared to controls. 68 people taking guesses. We all took a vow of secrecy during the experiment. We promised we would not say anything about our reading to the others. The next morning, we trooped into Gary's little lab building to read our first sitter. Lisa Jackson had recruited someone from north of Tucson, as we found out later, a 46-year-old woman named Pat Price, who had suffered through the deaths of 6 people close to her in the past 10 years. Prior to our arrival, Gary and Linda had her fill out a detailed questionnaire about her losses. And that morning, they had her sign a statement affirming that she had no contact with any of the mediums before the experiment. Suzanne went in first. and Gary told me later he was not prepared for the sheer force of her style. Now, Suzanne is no wallflower to begin with, but when she's connecting, she kicks into a whole different mode. She's all over the place. Her hands are going, and if this is even possible, she speaks faster than I do. She's just alive with information. And with Pat Price, I later learned, Suzanne really got in the zone, talking without seeming to stop for a breath, pouring out fact after fact after fact that Pat had to keep up with to validate. My jaw was on the floor, Gary said later. She was talking nonstop like a cab driver from New York and getting all this highly specific information. Pat was nodding and crying, and the most emotional piece of information was that Pat had lost her son. I went next and probably seemed like Ben Stein in comparison. The electrodes were attached, not two or three as I thought, but 19, kept together on my head with a kind of shower cap. The first and strongest energy that came through was a male figure to Pat's side. It seemed to be her husband. I asked her if she understood the messages, and she said yes. A younger male figure also came through connected to Pat's husband. I believed it was their son, and he had shot himself to death. Under normal circumstances, I would have just said it, but I was concerned about telling Pat something so sensitive in front of the cameras. I thought quickly and just said, I feel like it's a boom. They go out, boom. There's like a big explosion or some type of big boom that happens. Does that make sense? Yes. Others came through, but it was Pat's husband's energy who remained the strongest. I told her that I was being shown a bouquet of pink roses, a way of expressing love. Then I got a sequence of information, all of which she validated. You did not have the opportunity to talk to him in the way that you wanted to talk to him prior to his passing, correct? Right. Okay, now I'm being made to feel that either his mother passed very young in his life or that he was absent or distant from her in life, that there might have been some type of emotional disconnect somehow. And I feel like on the other side, they were able to reconnect that. Okay? That's what I'm being shown. Do you understand that? Yes. He's telling me it's okay. He wants you to know that it's okay. He's making me feel like that's why he's made it so important for you to know that he's here. He wants me to also confirm to you that he's made a visit to you. And what I classify as being a visit is where somebody comes through to you without a psychic. And he's telling me to confirm for you where he came to you, where he was standing in what looks like to me to be a bedroom, where there was a closet door that's open and you had been smelling his clothes or you were smelling something that's connected to him. Does that make sense? Oh yes, Pat said. There was just one strange thing about this reading. Pat Price's husband was not dead. In fact, he was sitting outside the room. I was very unnerved when I was introduced much later. So much so that I didn't ask why she kept validating that he had died, or so it had seemed. I was glad her husband was alive, but I thought I had completely misinterpreted the messages and I had really blown the session, while being tested in a university laboratory on national television. The whole thing was very confusing, both how I had gotten something so wrong and why the sitter kept saying I was right when I was very wrong. One possible explanation for both these unusual circumstances would only emerge months later. George, Lori, and Anne followed to complete this grueling day for Pat, who must have felt overpowered for days afterward. I found out later that she heard some of the information over and over again, including her son Mike's death, which all of us got, although not everyone got it as a suicide. When I told Gary at the end of the day that I had gotten the suicide but awkwardly tried to protect Pat by describing it as a boom, he was very skeptical. He wondered if I had heard from Pat or one of the other mediums after my session that it actually was a suicide and was now trying to claim I had known it all along. Well, he didn't know me and he had to maintain his scientific objectivity, entertaining all possibilities until he could eliminate them. He never told me this until much later, after we had gotten to know one another. A few months after the test, Pat Price was brought back into the lab to carefully score transcripts of each of the sessions. Every utterance by all five mediums was put in one of six categories: name, initial, historical fact, personal description, temperament, and opinion. And Pat then evaluated each statement and assigned it one of seven ratings, everything from possibly correct to definitely an error. Gary and his colleagues sat with Pat and made her justify every rating. Then they put the data into an Excel computer file. When Gary tabulated the data, he wouldn't tell us who had the higher score because he didn't want it to be a competition or at least he wanted to minimize our natural instincts. He saw this as a team effort. The important result for him was our cumulative performance. He found that our accuracy rates range from 77 to 93%, with our total average score as a group to be 83%. The results of the heart and brain tests were interesting. Gary's hypothesis was that if a medium was reading the energy of the sitter and you measured the brain waves and heart rates of both, you might find that their hearts or brains were in some way synchronized or coupled, like one of Gary's feedback systems. Maybe our two hearts would beat in coordination. But we as mediums believe the opposite is happening. We disconnect from the sitter because we're not really reading them. We're reading the energies and the spirits they come with. So Gary measured each of us at rest with our eyes closed and then during our readings. He found that on average, over the course of the readings, our hearts became not more synchronized, but less so, which would be consistent with our claim that we are not connecting with them, but with another entity. This happened with all five of us. As for brainwaves, our EEG patterns revealed no connection between the sitter's heart and our brains. When we were done and Gary gave us the numbers, Suzanne and I were thrilled. "Now we can say it's been proven," Suzanne said, just about ready to call Larry King herself. But Gary said, "Well, not exactly. It's not a perfect study," he said. "The flaw? He had not kept us apart after our readings. We hung out in the courtyard behind the lab, and even though he had someone with us, and even though the only conversation was between the mediums who had already done their readings, Gary said he could not say with 100% certainty that we did not trade information." Suzanne is the archetype of the straight-ahead, no-time-for-niceties New Yorker, and she was incensed, to use a nicety. The idea that we had cheated was absurd, not to mention insulting. Gary said he knew we had not cheated, had not broken the secrecy pledge, but this was science. If he was going to write this up for publication, present it as a landmark study and the foundation for the future, then he had to be able to say that cribbing had been eliminated as a possibility. "Then why didn't you think of that before the experiment?" Suzanne wanted to know. "So we come all the way out here and do this, and now we can't even say it's documented? That's bullshit." Gary wanted to do additional experiments, not for HBO, but for his own research, and Suzanne and I agreed to come back to Arizona twice more over the next 10 months. Ann Gaiman and Laurie Campbell joined us in the second experiment at a resort called Miraval. This time, each of us stayed in our own room and the sitters were brought to us. And besides not being able to see the sitter, who would be brought in behind us, we were not allowed to have any verbal communication for the first 10 minutes. This was called the Silent Sitter Experiment, and Linda and Gary devised it after arranging at the last minute to make one of the sitters Pat Price from the HBO experiment. Gary and Linda wanted to see if any of the mediums would be able to reconnect with Pat and the same people that came through during the first experiment. But they also wanted to make sure that we would not recognize her, hence starting the 10-minute silent period experiment. None of us did. But later, when they told us the reason that they had asked her to come back for a second experiment, I was bowled over. Only days before, Pat's husband had been killed in a car accident. And when I read her this time, he didn't come through. But her son did, acknowledging that this was a validation of the validation. Gary and I tried to sort through this irony one layer at a time. After the first reading in Tucson, I assumed that I had just been wrong, that I had not clearly discerned the energy and was connecting with someone else. But after the second reading at Miraval, I realized that it was Pat's son, Mike, who had committed suicide, who was giving me the information about his dad's imminent crossing over as a preparation for his mom. At Miraval, I also learned that Pat had some psychic ability of her own and, unknown to anyone, had a premonition of her husband's death before the Tucson test. That was why she had answered yes to everything I had said about her husband having passed away when he was sitting right outside the room. She was literally answering the question I asked, "Do you understand that?" What she meant was that she understood the information in the context of her own premonition. Had I asked more straightforwardly, "I'm getting that your husband has passed, is that true?" she would have answered differently. It also turned out that she was a little confused during the session. When I described her going into a bedroom and smelling an article of clothing, I felt it was coming from her husband. But this was something that she had done in her son's room after he passed. This was a perfect example of my personal adage. Sometimes I get it right, sometimes I get it wrong, but I get it. And in this case, I just assumed that the events had already happened. I thought the information was coming from Pat's husband when it was actually coming from her son about her husband. It's also important to note that every medium is also a psychic, which means we do have the ability to project future events. So there's always the potential for confusion. That's why it's important to understand the process and know that sometimes it's the things that make no sense at all that can turn into the greatest validation. When Pat came back to Miraval, before I knew it was her sitting behind me, it was her son who did the talking, and he told me, "This is a validation of the validation." And I didn't understand who the spirit was or what he was talking about until I turned around afterward and saw that it was Pat. And then I realized it was young Mike's way of saying, "You screwed up last time. That was me trying to prepare my mom, so let's get it right this time. Now tell my mom I'm with Dad and we're okay." A few months after the Miraval tests, Gary brought the sitters to Tucson for the same kind of detailed scoring session that he'd had with the sitters in the first experiment. Our cumulative accuracy rate was 82%. There was a relatively small difference between the silent period and the questioning period. We were 77% accurate when we could neither see the sitter nor verbally communicate with him. When we could speak, our accuracy rate rose to 85%. The 90-minute HBO special, Life After Life, aired on October 5th, 1999, and featured more of me than I expected, or actually would have liked. I also thought the program really didn't do justice by Suzanne Northrup. Very little of her phenomenal reading of Pat, the sitter, in the HBO experiment survived the editing. But Lisa Jackson did a fine job treating the material seriously and exploring it more openly and thoroughly than anyone had done before. She didn't take a position in our favor, as I hoped she might, but she didn't try to debunk us either. She played it right down the middle, showing us in good moments in Gary's lab and private readings, along with interviews with skeptics, intelligent and reasonably dispassionate academics, not show business cynics who don't have the intellectual curiosity to really explore what this is all about. Gary and Linda did the last of the three tests a month after the HBO special aired, then went on to write up their findings in a 29-page paper for the Journal of the Society for Psychical Research, a publication devoted to the exploration of psychic phenomena. Not exactly science, but as Gary says, none of the big scientific journals will touch this stuff, so you publish where you can, where there are open minds. But it didn't keep him from presenting his work and data with the highest scientific integrity and in careful language. While the findings didn't speak to the question of how we were doing this, Gary suggested that further research with brainwave measurements might offer some clues. And anticipating the skeptics, he noted, "Traditional hypotheses of fraud, subtle cueing, and statistical coincidence are improbable explanations of the total set of observations reported here." Conscious of the concept of scientific certainty, Gary said he could not definitively rule out that HBO cooked up the whole thing with or without the complicity of the sitter or the mediums. Private detectives were not employed to attempt to independently verify confidentiality. However, it seems highly improbable that Lisa Jackson, an Emmy Award-winning producer who works for a multiple Emmy Award-winning production company, would risk her professional and personal reputation to engage in fraud at the University of Arizona. When Gary first started his research a few years ago, people would ask him whose side he was on, the mediums or the skeptics. "Well, I'm not on either side," he would say. "I'm on the side of the data. If the data takes me to the mediums, I go to the mediums. If the data takes me to the skeptics, I go to the skeptics. Now, if you ask me whose worldview I prefer, there's no question that the mediums is much more beautiful and special. But my job is not to test my beliefs. It's to follow the data. Are we trying to prove the survival of consciousness? No. What we're trying to do is allow survival of consciousness to prove itself. If mediums are willing to stand up and be counted, then science should be willing to stand up and count them. Six lies and videotape. Hits and misses. If we were 83% accurate in the Arizona experiment, well, what about the other 17%? Among skeptics and believers alike, there's a catchphrase to describe what's become a popular way to evaluate a medium: hits and misses. I hate those three words. To think spirit communication is about hits and misses is a miss itself. That implies that the misses are just wrong, but they're not. Even the 17% that Gary Schwartz counted as inaccurate. I believe that all the information I'm given is accurate. It's what happens next that counts. Any number of factors, the skill of the medium is a big one, but not the only one, will determine whether the information will be considered a hit or a miss. We may not always understand how spirits choose their messages or why they convey them with this symbol and not that one. But spirits don't play games or misstate. If I pass on 25 pieces of information and 19 are validated, it doesn't mean I've gotten 6 wrong, any more than it means that they've told 6 lies. What makes a piece of information a perceived miss is either a simple short out somewhere in the medium spirit recipient circuit or a delay in the validation. This may sound like a cop-out, but this really is a three-way partnership that requires positive, open, and strong energy from everyone involved on both sides of the Great Divide. If I bring through information that someone being read does not acknowledge, one of five things is happening. I have control over just one. 1. I'm misinterpreting the information I'm being shown, and that's a biggie. 2. The information is meant for someone else in the room, and we're not connecting strongly enough to get me to go there. 3. The sitter doesn't know whether the information is true or not because of an unfamiliarity with the family tree, or because this is simply something that he or she is not aware of yet. 4. The person does not want to acknowledge something for personal reasons. 5. The person is suffering from psychic amnesia, a temporary affliction that has been known to render people incapable of remembering their spouse's name or their child's birthday. Now take it from me, there are 1,000 ways for a medium to misinterpret a message from the other side. And the most common problem I have is receiving a symbol, often a fleeting one that fades as soon as the next one appears, and describing it incorrectly. The spirits will use my references, things I will recognize and relate to get me to say something. But as in a game of charades, I might see the symbol from the wrong angle and pass on the wrong information, or be too literal, or not literal enough. It's hopeless to ask why spirits give one symbol and not another. Does everyone who plays charades use the same clues? They give me what they give me, and I pass it on the best I can. Misinterpretation of a fleeting symbol or sound is only one of the two most common obstacles to the mythical perfect reading. Just as common is the delayed validation. Most often, it's a piece of information that a person doesn't know about and has to check out. Anything from a detail about an event from the past to the name of a neighbor's grandmother. And so many times I've been directed to deliver information to someone who seems to have no connection to the spirit, so of course can't validate the information. In many cases, it's because they actually do have some connection, but it's not obvious, and they may not even know it. I might be reading someone who's a distant or even unknown relative of a spirit that's trying to get a message through to another relative, or the person being read is a friend or acquaintance of the intended recipient. Trying to connect mutual acquaintances like this can lead to a lot of blank expressions and denials, which can be frustrating for all three of us. People often wonder why spirits use these indirect, unlikely connections. The answer is simple. It's their best chance to get a message through. I have an analogy for this. If you were stuck in some remote foreign land without a phone and ran into someone from your hometown who was on his way home, wouldn't you want that person to get a message to your family that you were all right? A murder in Michigan. There's one other kind of message that comes through and either seems like information that's 10 miles off the mark or makes people stretch in every direction to try to make it fit. And that's a message about something that hasn't happened yet. I don't know if I was foreshadowing Pat Price's husband's death when I interpreted him as being already crossed over, but it's not unusual for me to receive and pass on information that seems wrong at the time it's delivered, but later turns out to have meaning. It doesn't have to be earth-shattering, and often it's forgettable, maybe even a mundane event. The first time I met Carol Maywood, I told her in the course of a reading that someone was putting up new wallpaper. It didn't mean anything to her, but a few months later, somebody in her family, maybe it was her sister-in-law, changed the wallpaper in the bathroom, or maybe just the top part. I think they call that the border. It might have been the bedroom. See what I mean about mundane and forgettable? Which makes what happened later in that reading all the more extraordinary. Carol is a radiologist and a medical administrator from Phoenix. In May of 1998, she lost her sister Louise, who died as suddenly as it is possible to die of cancer. It came out of nowhere and devastated her family. Flipping channels one day later that year, Carol saw me on one of the afternoon shows and was curious enough to go out and buy the first book she had ever read on spirit communication. Carol had always believed that when we die, our energies merge with the universal force and we cease to exist as individuals, that our personalities go on only in the memories of those we leave behind. What I and others were saying was very different. She liked the way it sounded. One day in the spring of 1999, Carol's brother Dan called from his home in Michigan to say he had seen me on the Crier Report. They had discussed the subject, and Carol had thought about what it might be like to connect with her sister. And was it even possible? John Edward is going to be in Phoenix, Dan told her on the phone. You've got to call and get tickets. I'll give you the number. You have to go. Carol was taken aback by the force of Dan's demand. She didn't mind. They were extremely close, and it was hard for them to offend each other. But still, it was not at all like Dan to tell her what to do about anything. Carol made the call and went with her mother to the event I was having in downtown Phoenix. She hoped she would be read, but it didn't look like it was going to happen. 2 hours into the event, and nothing for Carol and her mother. But then, and I'm telling you this from her perspective, of course, based on what she told me later, I asked if anyone had a Holland connection. I was feeling an older male figure and being shown wooden shoes. Nobody acknowledged it. But when she saw that I was slowly walking in their direction, Carol whispered in her mother's ear and then raised her hand. Tentatively, as people usually do when they're really not sure if it's for them, but since nobody else is claiming it. Well, Carol's uncle Stephen, her mother's brother, had married a wartime bride from Holland, and both of them had passed. The next sequence of information confirmed that I was in the right place. It was the typical family gathering, except that, to her disappointment, Carol's sister was not among them. Then, toward the end of the reading, they were telling me that the whole family would be getting together soon. My sister's birthday is in July, Carol said, almost desperate to make her sister a part of this. Nope, I said. Sooner than that, it's in about a week, and they're telling me they're all going to be there. It was nothing that they knew of, Carol said. I wondered if I was blowing someone's surprise party. This is one of those times when the people I saw in front of me were saying no, and the ones I couldn't see were saying yes. In cases like this, my money is always on the ones who got in for free. When Carol got home, she called Dan in Michigan. She was glad her brother had told her to go, and although Louise didn't come through, Carol and her mother were really happy to have been read. She recounted the reading, and then they tried to figure out what that family gathering thing was all about. What could be happening in just a week? They couldn't figure it out, but Carol and Dan talked twice more that week about the reading, about Louise, and about Dan's upcoming visit to Carol in Arizona. Could that be the gathering? Early on Saturday morning, the phone rang in Carol's house, and she heard these words in her sister-in-law's voice. Dan is dead. He had been found in his car, in the parking lot of the factory plant where he worked the overnight shift. He had been shot in the head with his own gun. In a year's time, Carol had lost both her sister and brother without warning, at least none that she had been able to perceive. When she regained a semblance of equilibrium, Carol thought about the imminent family gathering her relatives had talked about. She didn't think they meant Dan's funeral. He was cremated, and there would not be a memorial service until his birthday, months later. Then Carol realized what it was. She calculated that Dan had died exactly 7 days and 4 hours after her reading. The family gathering they were talking about was on the other side. They were the ones who would be getting together, helping Dan cross over. Now the question became, what happened to Dan? The police in Michigan immediately ruled Dan's death a suicide and closed their investigation without conducting standard crime scene tests or questioning people connected to him. Carol, her sister-in-law, and others close to Dan could not believe he had killed himself. Dan had been divorced and had remarried just 3 years before. His wife was devastated, totally out of it, and Carol had all she could do to stand up herself. Besides her own grief, she had to deal with telling her parents that now two of their children were dead. It was a week before Carol was able to begin thinking about the investigation of her brother's death. She was sure he had been murdered, and so was everybody else in Dan's circle of family and friends. He had not been depressed, and he had been making all kinds of plans. He had bought train tickets for a trip to the Grand Canyon he and his wife were going to take during a visit to Carol in Arizona a month later. They were planning to move to Texas after his retirement in 2 years, and he was trying to convince Carol to move there also. He had arranged to leave work in time to go to his friend's wedding reception on Saturday, and he had taken chicken and ribs out of the freezer to defrost and marinate for the weekend. Once she was sure he had not committed suicide, Carol began to think about who might have killed him. Dan had no enemies, she thought, but then she realized that he did. Dan had been in a legal dispute with someone he had hired to restore a 1965 Thunderbird. The man did a terrible job and cheated him, leading to an angry confrontation in the parking lot outside Dan's apartment. Dan had recently won a $30,000 court judgment against him. Carol learned that the man thought he wouldn't have to pay because he was declaring bankruptcy, but believed that Dan informed him that bankruptcy rules didn't apply to frauds. He would still have to pay him the money. Not long after the judgment, Dan was dead. Carol thought the obvious suspect had to be the man Dan was having problems with, a young guy named Baxter. One night soon after Dan's death, Carol decided to sit down at her computer and put down everything she knew and everyone she had talked to, an organized chronology of the events leading up to that night in the parking lot. And while she was doing that, she became aware that she was seeing the events playing out in her head in great detail. "It was like a videotape running in my head," Carol recalled, "as if I were watching a mystery movie. There was a distinction between my own thoughts when I started typing and when this started taking over." Without missing a beat, Carol kept typing, only now she was transcribing what she was seeing in her head. Baxter pulls up, walks over to Dan's car, then opens the passenger door to come in as Dan demands that he show him the money. But Baxter grabs for Dan's jacket and holds the door open, and Dan immediately cocks his gun and points it at Baxter, telling him to stop, put the jacket down, and leave. But Baxter angrily grabs for the gun, dropping Dan's jacket, the keys in the pocket jingling as they hit the blacktop. Quickly, Baxter leans into the car and overpowers the much smaller Dan, twisting Dan's arthritic hand so that the cocked gun is now pointed at Dan's head. Now Baxter begins to laugh, gloating at the situation. Dan uses his left hand to try to force the gun upward and away from him, but Baxter uses his other hand to keep it down. As they struggle, Baxter shoves the gun hard against Dan's head, and it fires. The bullet casing ricochets off the ceiling, hits Baxter, and lands on the passenger seat near the door. Shocked, Baxter releases his grip and lowers Dan's hands to his lap, still holding the gun. He backs out of the car, picks up the jacket and keys, hastily replaces them on the seat, leaving a bloody smudge on the jacket lining. He looks around and sees no one has responded to the gunshot, and drives carefully away. Carol said the scene flowed seamlessly from one moment to the next, but seemed to be in response to her questions. She didn't think they came from her imagination because the details, Dan's elaborate preparations, the sounds of the jangling keys dropping to the pavement, were too vivid and came too quickly. "This didn't feel at all like that," Carol said. "Of course, you wonder if this is just your mind at work, but it didn't feel as if it was coming from me." She entertained the stunning possibility that this videotape had been sent to her by Dan, but she didn't dwell on it because it was just too strange and unsettling. and she was careful whom she talked to about it. She tried to have the case reopened, or really, opened, but got nowhere. All she had in the view of the police was speculation. Over the next 2 years, Carol became a regular at events I had in the West. She came to 5 more after the first one in Phoenix. In Salt Lake City, San Diego, Las Vegas, Scottsdale, and Detroit, traveling hundreds of miles in the hopes of connecting with her siblings. She wanted to know the truth. She hoped Dan would give it to me to relay, but these were events with a few hundred people, and she was disappointed each time. Most of the time, I didn't even know she was there. But her story has stayed with me. When I think of Dan's apparent desire to literally show his sister what happened, and compare it to the way Roger only wanted to ease Nicole's mind in Tampa Bay, I can't help but feel sure that spirits really do give us what we need. We're all different, those of us here on Earth, and those on the other side. If Carol still had any strands of belief that our individual personalities dissolve into some great universal abyss when we die, she could now let them go into the wind. Legends of Rock, Debbie's Daddy. One day during the winter of 1998, I got an email from a friend, Stephen Reed, wondering if I might do him a favor. He hated to ask, he knew I was busy, but would I be able to squeeze in a reading for someone? She had just lost her dad, and it would really mean a lot. Like most of my friends, Stephen knew I don't like to do readings as favors because it's not fair to the people who are on my waiting list. So for him to ask, I figured it must be pretty important, and I was getting a do it feeling from the boys. So I said, sure, no problem. The woman's name was Debbie, and she sure was from Tennessee. I told her I knew she had just lost her dad, but I had to be honest with her. I had no control over who would come through. Sometimes it's the person we least expect or want to hear from.